So much material. It's the material that I taught when I taught at Grace, and it took me literally the whole semester, 2 hours at least every week, dealing with this material in order to get through it. And I'm going to try to do that today in about an hour and 15 minutes, and then open it up for a lot of questions. And so obviously I got a task ahead of me, and you too. If you write slowly, you will not get anything out of today. Okay? Really, what I want to do, like some of the material you've got there, it's going to be some things that I'm just going to touch on, and you can kind of stick in your notes. And a lot of the overheads and things that I'm going to put up here is just a thing for you to just maybe get the basics of it so that you can understand the chart and this type of thing, and then be able to take this material when you get home and really think it through. If anything, I expect you to walk out of here today knowing just a little bit more about depression and what's going on and how to deal with it. But you've got the material, and you might think of this material as a catalyst to really help you understand much more deeply the ramifications of what we're talking about. That's why the second page of what I've got there is nothing more than Linda and I got some scissors out today, and we cut some pages out of an article that I wrote in the IBC Perspective in 1984. Because some of the deal with mothering that's related to the primary loss and with people struggling with depression, some of those things I think you need to know. And rather than you taking notes on all this, I thought, well, let's just give that to you. And if you want to know more about that, you can get the perspective and really get into it. Okay, before I get started, several of you are saying, who are you? So let me tell you who I am. I'm one of the guys that played hooky last night, okay? My name's Dave Harrell. I interned with Larry, I guess it was 2 years ago, up at Grace, and then I taught for another year at the seminary, and then I moved to Nashville, Tennessee. I'm trying to finish up my doctorate in counseling psych and got a practice down there, and I deal primarily with Christian leaders. That's mainly who my clientele is. And so Larry asked me to come here and basically teach you what I tried to teach in seminary. And maybe what I could preface my remarks by saying is simply this. Those of you that have not had a great deal of interaction at a counseling level with depressed people are going to find some of this material maybe a little extra complicated. In a way, like when I taught at Grace, I noticed that at times I felt like I was teaching scuba diving to people that had never been swimming. And because a lot of the students were there that had never had a depressed person sit across from them. Now, we've all been around depressed people, and some of us even here in here, I'm sure, have been depressed, even though maybe my definition of depression in a minute might kind of shock you. But nonetheless, if you haven't been around these types of people, this might be a little bit confusing to you. And all I'm saying is just get it anyway, and then when you do come in contact with them at more of an intimate type of level, I think you're going to understand much better what's going on. Now, before I get started, how many of you do deal a lot with depressed people? Okay, good. I figured that a lot of people in here are coming because you've had a lot of the same questions that I have. What in the world do you do? Right? Okay. In order to give you a handle on what's going on with it, the first thing that I think is very important to do is look at that first sheet. And let's just get an idea of what we're talking about. First of all, there's a big difference between sadness and depression. We all experience some degree of sadness at times. But the thing that we're looking at is something that's somewhat bizarre. Certain things happen and we kind of wonder, why do some people react with sadness and other people react with depression? It doesn't make sense. And what we're going to be saying here is, ultimately, this is what we're going to be talking about today. Now, before I get down here, let me explain something. With sadness, you can have the transient blues. You know, we all kind of have the ups and downs. I've had a bunch of those just this week, and you have too. And then there's also this type of sadness, which you might say is a major grief reaction when somebody dies or whatever. Well, that's not the type of thing that we're going to be talking about today. We're talking about this end of the continuum, this type of depression in which there's, we'll say, two types. One is the secondary type, which is typically associated with medical illnesses. You know, an amputee or somebody that's just found out they've got cancer or those types of things. Again, that's not the type of depression I'm going to be talking about today. We're talking about a primary depression, but there's also two types here. There's one type, and again, this is not the type we're talking about today, is the bipolar type, or the manic. You've got the lows and highs, the manic depressive type people. And there you've got an organic predisposition to the problem. In other words, there's some kind of a medical type related problem along with a psychological problem. That's what the little Greek psi stands for there. That's my shorthand. All right. But on the other hand, with primary depression, you have another type, the unipolar type, the type that's just the type that we see the most, in which there's not really any clear trigger necessarily. We can't really name one thing that has triggered what is going on. But even with that, there's two types. One type is the familial pure, which is nothing more than a lot of hereditary things. In other words, when you see this type of thing going on, you can probably check and find out that somewhere in this person's past, they've got some genetic background that might predispose them to depression, along with a lot of psychological type problems. And by the way, when I say psychological, realize that I'm using that synonymously with spiritual. All right? But this is the type we're talking about. In other words, people, what I'm saying is out of all the depressed people that you're going to run in contact with, they're going to be somewhere in here, but 90% of them are going to be right here. In other words, it's going to be just a plain old unipolar type depression. There's not two poles to it. It's just people are depressed. We can't really figure out what the trigger is. And approximately 90% of all depressed people fall into that category. Yeah. 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 And don't get hung up with all this technical stuff. Yeah. You're ahead of me, but let me go ahead and answer that real quick. When in doubt, refer them. All right? Yeah, when in doubt, to a physician, especially an internist. Hopefully I'll have time to get into that too. Very seldom will I send anybody to a psychiatrist. Okay? I mean, if you want band-aids for cancer, then yeah, send them to a psychiatrist. That's pretty much my view. And the reason I say that is not only from experience, but also from a good friend of mine, Dr. David Lewis, is being groomed to take over the organic depression department of the University of Iowa Hospitals. And I've gotten a lot of my information from him on this medical type thing. And he basically states that psychiatry right now is about two stages above witchcraft. All right, and if anybody should know, he should. And so when you see lots of problems going on, and I'm going to give you a list of them later on. I mean, like when you see almost kind of bizarre things going on. I mean, the person can't eat and nothing brings any pleasure. They can't sleep and on physical type things that are there. When in doubt, always err on the side of, hey, go get checked out first. And let an internist really check them out. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. I would put him somewhat there, but I would put him very highly here. In other words, I'm going to deal with him basically just like I would anybody else. Okay? But it's kind of like this, if I can draw this on here real quick. And we're already getting way late, but that's okay. It's like people will have physical problems. And let me put a 1, 2, 3. And we also have the psychological or spiritual problems. Now, let's say that in terms of problems, at a physical or a psychological level, we all are at least a 1. I mean, we've all got things we're wrestling with. Some of us are way over here. All right? Like, I'm aging. It means I'm dying gradually. So I'm a 1. But now some people are further this way. Now, for instance, the alcoholic, if he's got a chemical dependency, he's going to be probably way over here, right? In other words, there's some physical problems in there. But he may also be living right in here. Now, in terms of an equation, you might say the problems here, 3 times 3, well, what do you got? You got 9. And so one of the things I want to do before I start working on this, because this people is where we're working, unless you're a physician like Dr. Dave here or something, what I'm going to do is want to work on this. But before I'm going to work on this, you know what I want to do? I want to get this down to maybe at least here. I want to get him to a doctor. I want to get some help physically. I'd love to at least maybe even get him here. And now look at what I've got to deal with. 3 times 2, well, I'm down to 6, you might say. or 3 times 1, well, I'm down to 3. And then if I can get this down to here, well, you see how the numbers maybe can illustrate what I'm trying to say. So when in doubt, of all people, send them to a doctor. I know of a... It's really sad. It just went through my mind. I know of a situation that just happened not too long ago. As a matter of fact, I know of several, but this one really stands out to me. A gal was severely depressed, and I think there was some organic predisposition to it. And she had gone in for help, and she was on some medication. And the medication was stabilizing her. And she ran across some biblical counselors who basically told her to kind of let go and let God and just trust the Lord. And the thing that she had to do, the very first thing they checked out, since they're biblical counselors, was her devotional life. And they got her on a real good devotional life, which just added really more pressure to her. And had her memorize verses and checked, found out she wasn't going to church. And had her doing all these things. And the other big thing that they did, and here's people, please hear this. Not only obviously is that wrong, and I think you know why, but the other thing that they did is they said, you don't need the medication anymore. Okay, so they took her off the medication, and in 2 weeks she killed herself. And you just don't want to do that type of thing. Okay? And so don't tinker around where you don't know where to tinker around with the medical things. Okay, where are we? Let's get rolling here with just trying to understand, first of all, the etiology and the dynamics of depression. In other words, what causes it? How can we understand it? Let's try to get a picture of what's going on. The thing that I want you to think about is, why do some people, instead of getting sad, get depressed? For instance, why would somebody, when they get fatigued, fall into a depression? Why is it that somebody, and I'm thinking of actual situations, and I'm sure you've got some too, you're going, I can't figure this out. Why would, like I know of one person who, the husband continued to gain accolades of praise through the group that he was working with, ministry type situation. And the husband finally got another grand promotion, and the wife went into severe depression. You know, how do you make sense out of that? Now, let me ask you this. What do we typically do when something doesn't make sense to us? Okay, and what do we, I mean specifically, and I know there's lots of ways, but what do we typically do when something doesn't make sense to us? Oh, what did he say? Withdraw. Okay, now more specifically, in other words, if I were to say, what's a manifestation of withdrawal? Especially with people in church. Okay, and how does that, what do we typically do? How do we ignore it? Okay. Well, we could go on and on, but let me get ahead of you. You know what we typically do when something doesn't make sense? We send them to the professional. Right? We send them to the professional, the one that's supposed to understand all these things. And you know what they're going to do by and large? The very same thing that they're teaching me to do, which I'm not going to do. What we do is we test them, run them through a battery of tests so that we can tell you that they're depressed. So that we can therefore not only tell you what you already know to be true, but so that we can somehow figure out how we can rearrange what? Their circumstances. All right? So we will desperately try to rearrange the circumstances. And if that doesn't lift the depression, then you know what the next step is? Medication. You see how that goes? Rather than doing that, people, one of the things that excites me about secular training, even though I'm not learning anything about people, learning a lot about organisms, I'm not learning anything about people, but the thing that I'm excited with is to see how that these people are at least asking good questions. And typically in our circles, we don't ask good questions. When we get stuck, we just say, well, the Bible isn't sufficient here. Yeah, it's authoritative, but it's not sufficient. So therefore, send them to the professional. And I want you to say, no, wait a second. The Scriptures really are sufficient. If we don't understand something, what we need to do is go back into the text and find out, what don't we understand? Let's start asking good questions of the text. So that's what we're going to try to do today. Let me tell you just a little bit about maybe a definition of depression. And you don't have to get this down necessarily. And I've got some other things in the notes, and I'm not really there yet. But normally what people are going to describe when they're depressed is they're going to describe a feeling, and many times it's the very same analogy, which I think is fascinating. They're going to describe this feeling of being in a cold, dark cellar, and it's damp in there, and there's no door, and there's no light. There's no hope. There's no relationship. All of those types of things. It's like there's no way out. That feeling of being trapped. One good book that I'm going to recommend among a couple is by a man named Beck, and I'll give you that later. But he says that depressed people kind of see things in a triad. They will have a negative view of self, of their world, and of their future. That's very common. Negative view of themselves, their world, and their future. Now, just even with that little bit of data, what do you think advice like, hey, don't you know we're more than conquerors? How dare you be depressed, as Larry mentioned the other night. What do you think that person would say when they heard that? If they've got a negative view of those three things. You know what they're going to say? Yeah, that's true. Why can't I be that way? As opposed to, oh, thank you. Yes. The lights are on and now I'm starting to get better. See, it doesn't work that way. Okay, let's turn to page, 207 I've gotten written here. You should have something there. About an awareness of neither dignity nor depravity. In order to understand this chart, what I'd like to do is maybe begin with this and just fly through this, just again so that we can touch on it, you can have it in your notes, and then think it through later. But in essence, the root of depression is an awareness of neither of these two things. And unless you understand this, you're not going to know how to really help a person that's depressed, okay? First of all, they have no dignity. And as I've gotten written there, and I'm going to repeat some of these things because there's a lot of people that are going to be listening to these tapes, okay? So don't let me insult your intelligence, but I want to go ahead and read. I have no dignity. I have no value because others have made it clear that I have none. They have not come through for me as I needed them to. Therefore, I am without value. And therefore, you might say that the identifiable loss is typically some clear, painful event in which the world has once again confirmed my lack of value by disappointing me. Hear the anger underneath that? Kind of that sense of, it's like I've tried everything I could to get my world to do what I demand, and nothing works, and I'm mad. And not only am I mad, but I've given up. Nothing I do makes any difference anyway, so why try anymore? All right. Not only that, not only is there no awareness of dignity, but there's also obviously not an awareness of depravity. I'm aware at most only of my longings, not of my demand that others come through. I am desperately committed to finding what I need in this world, and I do not regard that as wrong. Self-protection, if recognized at all, is seen as inevitable, normal, and necessary, therefore acceptable. Many times they're going to say, well, what do you expect me to do? You know, kind of angrily. So without an awareness of depravity, there can be no repentance at a core level, which can change goals from ignore God and con others. In other words, thanks God, but I can make life work on my own. I've got all these strategies decided to try to make things happen for me, to fill my personal circle, if you want to use that jargon, versus worship God and serve others. And therefore, there could be no experience of dignity. In other words, all that I'm merely saying at this point is that a person will never enjoy and appreciate their dignity until they understand their depravity. Okay? Until we understand the incredible chasm between who we are as sinful people versus what we've got potentially in our Lord, we're never going to appreciate our justification and our dignity. You with me on that? Okay? Now, there's 3 points that I want you to get down, and then we'll go back to your notes. But before I give you these 3 points, I want to give you just one scenario in particular. Before I understood anything about depression, I encountered, really for the first time, someone that was severely depressed. And let me tell you what happened, and based on what you know here, you kind of helped me analyze what you think's going on. I went to a marriage retreat, and this particular guy and his wife were there, and we noticed that he was just kind of always walking around like this. You'd say something to him, hi. You sense a pull? People, you with me? You sense a pull? What do you feel like doing? One of the things you're going to find out later, that the worst thing you can do to a depressed person is affirm them. But that's exactly what they want. All right. So he's kind of walking around like this. And about the first day or so, I found myself saying, hey, I'm going to use the name Dave, because that's my name. That's easy to remember. Hey, Dave, everything okay? You all right? You seem kind of down. Well, yeah. Things could be better, I guess. You know, that type of thing. And I found myself going, oh, I don't know what to do with this. Of course, I used to be intimidated to death with getting involved in people's lives anyway. So I did the thing that I think most of us do. We kind of want to change the subject and say, well, you know, everything's going to be okay. And, you know, let's go have a good time. Man, isn't this a great, isn't it a beautiful day? Wow. And now I feel comfortable. I haven't done anything for him, but at least I'm out of the hole, you see. So anyway, I found myself, the first few encounters, feeling that way. Like, you poor baby type thing. And you know how I felt about the third or fourth time I came across the guy? Notice how I'm standing right now? You know, like, oh, gee, here he comes again. And I can remember one time, for instance, we went out to play volleyball. And, well, actually in this big gym. Here's all of the couples, you know, we're out there having a great time, really having fun. And all of a sudden, who should come in but Dave? Same thing, comes walking in and kind of walks over the corner, kind of plops himself down. And again, we all felt the pull and, hey, Dave, come on, play with us, come on. You know, and after about the 14th time, he came. And the ball would come to him and, you know, he'd fall. And boy, by this time, I was just getting furious. I was just thinking, on one hand, I was thinking, I don't know what to do, so therefore I'm uncomfortable, therefore I don't want to do anything except feel mad. But on the other hand, I thought, there's something right about feeling angry. There's something going on here. I don't understand it, but something's going on. Well, anyway, the fascinating thing that that night, we found out that he had to go to the hospital. I thought, oh my word, man, now I was feeling guilty. Oh no, I was ready to, I felt like punching this guy out, you know. And here the poor guy's in the hospital. And so several of us guys went to the hospital, and his wife was there crying, and I felt about like this. I thought, gee, I was really wrong. I'm glad he didn't really see me angry. I was able to cover that up. I'm a good Christian, you know. So anyway, I went into that to the hospital, and the doctor finally came out, and we said, oh, man, what's wrong? You know, what's going on? And he said, well, I really think that he's just under a lot of stress. He's very depressed, and all that merely happened is he hyperventilated. And what I found out that happened is he was feeling so bad about himself in so many ways that he began to, and this I found out a lot later, he went into the van with his wife and just really tried to pull from her, and she was getting angry with him, and so what he began to do is cry, and he just got himself worked up to a point where he hyperventilated and had to go to the hospital. And it was so fascinating. As he came out of that hospital emergency room, he kind of had a little bit of a smile, and it was kind of like, I kind of felt like a junkie that had just given somebody some dope. Because there I was with all these guys, and, oh, man, Dave, are you okay? All right, now, in order to maybe understand what's going on with a situation like that, and I don't think that's too atypical, okay? I'm going to give you some other examples later on, and then later on when we talk, I know you're going to give me some. But that's really quite common. In order to understand that, let me give you 3 points. And here's where I want you to just kind of write fast and get some of the basics down. First of all, number one, realize that dignity, which is valid, will not develop without first repenting of the core commitment to self-protection. Realize that dignity, which is valid, that self-esteem which comes from worshiping God and serving others and all this type of thing, realize that dignity, which is valid, will not develop without first repenting of the core commitment to self-protection. Therefore, becoming aware of depravity, you might want to put in parentheses there, manipulative self-protection. Therefore, becoming aware of one's depravity must precede any valid movement. Must precede any valid movement towards relief of depression. Doesn't that sound cruel at first? I mean, it's the exact thing that we don't want to do. It's like the guy's hurting bad enough. What do you want to do now? Tell him how manipulative he is? Ultimately, yeah. How to do it is another thing. We'll get into that later. But you got to keep this in mind, theoretically. Yeah. What did I say? Therefore, becoming aware of depravity must precede any valid movement towards the relief of depression. That's point number one. You all got that? Therefore, becoming aware of depravity, you'd never make it through our program. I'll tell you, if you try to take notes from Larry, you know, like that. So you got to use shorthand here. Therefore, becoming aware of depravity must precede any valid movement towards the relief of depravity or depression. Okay? Second point. Therefore, the depressive must not be affirmed. I'm going to qualify that in a minute. Therefore, the depressive must not be affirmed. He must be confronted with his real motives in the context of relationship. Therefore, the depressive must not be affirmed. He must be confronted with his real motives in the context of relationship. And maybe just parenthetically there, you can put that affirmation just produces a temporary lift. All it does is give, kind of like the junkie more dope type thing. Let me give you a third point, and then I'm going to give you another example. Thirdly, and I think after this is kind of the bulk of your writing. Thirdly, awareness of wrong strategies must not be. Awareness of wrong strategies must not be followed with immediate efforts to change. Awareness of wrong strategies must not be followed with immediate efforts to change. These efforts will typically reflect a pressure. These efforts will typically reflect a pressure to earn acceptance. These efforts typically reflect a pressure to earn acceptance. And just the last sentence with that, and I think is so important. Please get this down. Obedience must grow out of an awareness of acceptance. Obedience must grow out of an awareness of acceptance, even while the wrong strategies are still in place. Obedience must grow out of an awareness of acceptance even while the wrong strategies are in place. By the way, after this is over, any of these overheads, any of my notes, they're available to you. If you want to copy more things down, you know, just let me know. Okay, now go to your chart. You got a chart there on what, page 206 or something like that? 205. This character right here. Okay. One of the reasons I got the pages like that is I just had them copy the pages right off my overheads, and so if you want to use those for overheads someday, you can. And another thing too, you're going to find out later that a good, almost a technique type thing to do at certain intervals in working with depressed people is to show them some type of a chart that kind of makes some sense out of everything for them. Okay. Because they're in just incredible confusion. All right, now, what we're going to do, we've first of all talked a little bit about, you know, up here, that there's neither dignity nor depravity with the person. And then somehow or another, there's an identifiable loss that comes in there. Now, mind you, many times the identifiable loss is not identifiable by the client. All right, and that's what you've got to look for. But in order to understand all of that, What we're going to want to do, in other words, in order to understand the pre-depressive personality that would therefore predispose a person to act with depression when this type of a loss comes along, is move all the way down to here for right now. Bear with me, we're going to make sense out of this whole thing later. But I want to come down to here and try to figure out what these two modes are. You're going to see style 1 and style 2, style 1 being a dependent mode, style 2 being a compensatory mode. More notes out here. What page is that on again? Okay. First of all, what we're gonna say is that people that ultimately end up in depression typically are predisposed in one of these two modes. Okay? In other words, you're gonna find a difference between two types of people. Not that they're going to be completely one way or completely another way. There's going to always be carryover, but you're going to see a general direction in one way versus another. And that is on your other page there, where you've got the two modes written out for you. First of all, you can have a primary dependency can be formed on approving relationships. Notice that there's going to be a difference here. The dependent mode person is going to move more towards relationships, where these types of people in the compensatory mode is going to move more towards achievement. That's going to be what hits their hot button. And I've got some things written down there that I think maybe help you understand that. Let's look at the two ends of the extreme here, and I'm going to give you some examples of people. First of all, the dependent type person, he's going to look for approving relationships. That's going to be his pull. That's going to be what hits his hot button. Okay? That's going to be what he's after. Whereas there's another type of person that relationships aren't really that big a deal. Rather than that, recognizable achievement is more what hits their hot button. The dependent mode type person is going to be very self-reflective to the point where it drives you nuts. You know, they just think about everything. This guy over here, everything's cool. Praise the Lord. You know, that's going to be kind of his attitude. Nothing bothers him. It's funny. It's like this type of person will say, like I know some pastors that I've worked with, a pastor in this mode here could have, as long as he has a big church, even if a lot of people don't like him, it doesn't bother him. But this type of pastor, even if he had a little bitty teeny church, that's okay as long as everybody likes me. You see the difference? All right. This type of person, feels guilty for everything. Can't do anything right. Whereas this type of person can't ever see anything wrong. Shallow, easily dismiss guilt. A good way of maybe thinking about the compensatory type person. Think about a lot of your highly visible executives. I know, like a lot of doctors and lawyers and pastors and kind of big shots, they very much more fit into that type of a category than do they the dependent type mode. All right, they're very confident and self-assured, whereas these people over here, they constantly feel inadequate. All right, these people in the compensatory mode, they actively refuse to worry or self-examine. They're kind of like a bull in a china shop. All right, the one thing that they're after is recognizable achievement. Another degree, another Mercedes. Boy, the people that I live with in Nashville, it's incredible. We got more millionaires per capita in Nashville than any city in the world. And it just continues to grow. And the people that I rub shoulders with, by and large, are these types of people. And it's so funny that you see so many of the men over here, so many of the women over here, but that's not always the case. But it's fascinating to see that these people, it's like they got so many anesthetizers in their life, they don't have time to feel anything. They don't need to feel anything. All they have to do is go buy something else. Okay? And so you're going to see a lot of this, especially in the wealthy. Excessive sociability. They're going to be out there all the time. Party, big time. These type of people in the dependent mode, that's not going to do much for them. These types of people here are going to stay after church. And they're going to kind of walk around the parking lot, just kind of waiting to talk to people. You know? These type of people here say, hey, let's go to such and such to eat. You know? And they're going to be gone. These type of people are going to be the leechy, overly relational. kind of the obsequious type. Hey, how you doing? You know, and they just keep on and on. And after a while, you feel like you've got a parasitic involvement with somebody. Whereas these people here, they don't have time for relationships. Okay? All right, I could go on and on. But in essence, that's two different types of people. Now, what you're going to see is that certain types of losses, therefore, are going to affect this type of person in a different way than it's going to affect this type of person, and vice versa. You with me on that? In other words, this is going to maybe help you understand what happens when a loss comes along, and maybe help you understand what type of loss you're looking for. Obviously, when you see this type of person come into your office, or your church, or wherever you're at, you're not going to really look for a loss that has something to do completely with relationship. But by the way, there's always going to be a carryover there. But you're going to look more for a loss in the area of recognizable achievement. By the way, you see that a lot in your professional athletes when they start to get over the hill. And the other thing that I might say while I'm thinking about it is the prognosis for this person ever getting better is much, much less than this person. When the identifiable loss really hits them and these people fall, and by the way, a lot of these people will never fall. They'll go to glory that way, some of them. Some of them go someplace else. But a lot of people will never have a loss that will produce that. But it's like when that wealthy businessman, like an attorney that I know, when that wealthy attorney lost his wife, it didn't bother him at all. Didn't bother him, didn't faze him. Matter of fact, if anything, it helped his business. But you know what destroyed him? When his group asked him to retire. Does that make sense to you now? A little bit? Okay. Now, let me give you an example. For instance, of a person that in this compensatory mode, and just to kind of get a feel, if you go back to the primary loss that we haven't even talked about yet, I want to give you just a little taste of what can happen. I'm going to talk about myself just a little bit in this compensatory mode, and maybe give you a feel. When I was young, I can remember learning very early on that love and value, especially value, was something that you had to earn. I can remember one time in specific, I was thinking about this today, in one of the groups, you know, we were asked to think about some of these things. And I can remember one time being in the shower in fifth and sixth grade and having a lot of welts on my legs from being spanked very severely by my mother, which was kind of a common thing. Mom's changed a lot since then, and I know this is confidential in here, but nonetheless, we had a lot of problems when I was young. And I can remember being so incredibly embarrassed because not only did I have welts on my legs, but at that particular age, at fifth and sixth grade, I wasn't as mature physically as some of the other boys. And boy, I'll tell you, when I had to take my clothes off and get in the shower, you talk about hurt. Oh, gee, and I can remember myself being in those showers and being kind of laughed at a little bit or kind of teased or whatever. And just inside, I remember, even right now, I can remember just sitting there with the showers running over my face so they wouldn't see my tears. Just being so hurt. But all along, you know what I was saying? Someday, nobody will ever laugh at me again. Someday, I will never feel this pain again. And you know how I begin to earn it? I, for a number of reasons, I began to move in the direction of achievement. That's what hit my hot button. I became a very excellent pianist at a young age. And I was groomed to become a concert pianist. My mother was a professional musician, and oh boy, I was really doing great in all of that. And then I found out that wasn't good enough. You know why? Because a lot of my friends kind of laughed at me for being the piano player. I had a lot of athletic ability, too. And so I thought, well, maybe I should try athletics. Well, my parents wouldn't let me do that because they'd spent too much money on the piano. You know, they didn't want me to hurt a finger, which you're going to find out is really fascinating later. But so I had to stick with the piano until I got into college. You know what the first thing I did when I was in college? I started purposefully failing out of Moody, right, which I wonderfully did in 2 years, even though my dad was one of the trustees there. I was able to fail out of Moody so my parents would not make me go back to Moody and have to study that piano anymore. I wanted to do something else that would make sure I would gain some respect. You know? And so, What I began to do after that is I started getting heavily involved with sports. I started playing basketball. I played basketball for 3 years in college and got involved heavily in boxing. See how all that starts making sense? I mean, I was consumed with these things. After that, or really along with that, I started rodeoing. I was heavily involved with rodeo. And praise God, in a karate tournament at Georgia Tech University, I was a black belt in karate. I had to get that one too, you see, because nobody's ever going to laugh at me again. At a karate tournament down there, a guy swept me and fractured my neck and also tore part of my finger off. And I got it sewed back on, and it's really pretty good, but I can't play the piano very good anymore. And so I kept moving into all these things. The only thing that hit my hot button was achievement. I had to have it. That was my dope. And as the Lord began to work with me, I began to realize that not all these things are really completely right, and God, I really do want to be used of you, so I began to substitute one symptom for something else. You know what I moved to then? Academics. I had to have degrees. I finally got out of college with over 200 hours. You know, I thought maybe that would do it. Of course, now I'm still at it. Been in school for 16 years. Still don't know anything. I think my motives are a little bit different now. But it's so fascinating. As I moved through life, I didn't really care that much about relationships. All I cared about was achievement. I wanted accolades of praise. I wanted Sunday school pins that hung down to here. You know? That's what hit my hot button. And so, as the Lord began to, or continued to work with me, what I began to find, as I say this, people, I feel somewhat hypocritical because it's not completely true, but there is a great deal of truth to what I'm about to say. You know what really makes me feel like a man now? A radical family life. That's what really does it for me. Now, if the Lord hadn't worked with me and I hadn't chose to really deal with some of the ways I was trying to manipulate my world to make sense out of life and all that type of thing, chances are I would still be in a very non-reflective type of mode, a very compensatory type mode, and then eventually, someday, when my whole world kind of collapses and I have no longer any repertoire of strategies to somehow pull it all off, you know what's probably going to happen to me? I'm probably going to get depressed. Now, does that make sense to you a little bit? On the other hand, if you want to look at the other mode here, and then after this I want to talk a little bit about the primary loss and what in the world I'm saying there. I think of so many situations. I'm going to go to a lady this time. I'm going to call her Joan. The lady came into my office. You know, if you want to scratch your head, here's one for you. She came into my office and she was Amish, 37 years old, and she wouldn't hardly look at me. She came in kind of like this. Hi. She'd walk almost like this, and she came over and she sat down real skinny, and it took me literally 2 sessions to ever even gain eye contact with her. And it also took me 2 sessions to find out that her presenting problem was she thought that sperm was all over everything. She was what we would call an obsessive compulsive. She washed her hands about 125 times a day. And I can see some of you kind of going, you know, how do you make sense out of that? Again, what do we typically do? Send that one to the professional, right? Well, I'm here to say that I think we are professionals if you understand these things. And you really can help people. Because I think the Bible definitely addresses a gal that walks into my office and says, I've got a phobia. I'm afraid that there's sperm all over everything. It's gotten so bad that I can't even breathe. It's gotten so bad that I can't stand to work anymore, go to work anymore. Nothing makes sense to me. Help me. Obviously, there's no proof text for that, and that's where we typically fall down, because we try to proof text the death out of everything. But they're principles. All right, so anyway, the gal was just really depressed. She couldn't work, and she had this phobia, and obviously she was scared to death of me. And if you were to look at what I had up here earlier, man, all those things there, goodness gracious, that was her. Scared to death of everything. And I was trying to figure out what really triggered not only the phobia, and by the way, we're now kind of off the track a little bit, but many times you're going to find that people that struggle with severe anxiety disorders, they're also going to be very depressed, needless to say. And in order to try to figure out the trigger, not that that's the witch hunt that you go on, that you go for, but in order to try to figure out and make sense out of some of that, I had to begin to do the first thing that you always have to do, and that's to begin to just build a relationship with her. Now, let me tell you just briefly what was going on with her. And then I think maybe you'll understand why the phobia and the depression made perfect sense. It was her only alternative, okay? As I worked with her, I found out that for her, as she was growing up, she could never, ever talk about anything sexual with her family. She could never, ever even feel anything sexual as her hormones begin to change, and as sometimes she would feel some sort of stimulation, as ladies will do. She felt horribly guilty about that. Why? Because love and value is earned. I mean, you can lose your salvation in a heartbeat. And for me to feel something sexual, for me to look at a guy and really think that maybe I would like to get to know him, and these times, she couldn't do that. She was too intimidated, too scared. And the word that kept coming up for her was defiled. I'm afraid I'm going to be defiled. And so, as is so typically the case with people struggling with anxiety-type problems, the thing that is out of control is so scary to them, and that is to somehow earn my acceptance and my worth from God and people and all this type of thing. And so what I've got to do is come up with something that I can control. Well, what I can control is all of this bizarre stuff with the sperm and all this type of thing. And so I'll wash my hands all the time. See, God, now I'm pure. Now will you accept me? See how that works a little bit? I'm leaving a whole lot of things out. I spent 2 years with her. Counseling isn't always, you know, 3 sessions. She's doing real well now. But it took just a little over 2 years. But anyway, as you look back at a person's background, what you're going to find is that somewhere along the line, there was what we want to call a primary loss. There was something that needed to be regained somehow, some way. This type of person, in the style one, is going to try to regain what was lost. And I know you're wondering, what do you mean by that? I'll get to that. This type of person tries to gain what was lost in a very different way than this type of person. And the loss is very different for this person than it is for this person. And somehow what you're going to see is that these two things here have a whole lot in common. Okay? By the way, I think one of the things that you're going to find fascinating about what we're discussing is how that this is nothing more than just maybe another way of talking about the whole model that you've had again this week. Is it not? Yeah, there's a few things that may be a little bit different, because depression obviously is a little bit different than some of the other types of things we struggle with. All right. We're doing pretty good on time. What I want to do now, in order to help you understand this loss, is have you turn to that sheet that is in the handout, the one behind the first sheet, the one on mothering. I'll tell you, hang on to that. I want to do something else first. I think maybe this would make better sense to you if I talked about this after the break. Let me do something before the break, all right? And maybe give you a little better understanding. Let's stick right with the two modes for a minute before I explain the loss. For the style one type person, just keep in mind that they're rarely bothered greatly by a failure to achieve. All right, just kind of keep that in mind. That's not really what sets them off. The style two person is rarely bothered by a failure in relationship or approval. You got that? The style one rarely bothered greatly by failure to achieve. That, you know, they can't achieve in anything, and that's kind of okay. The only thing they want is relationship. So there's like a primary dependency that is formed on somehow gaining relationship in my world. The other person is just the opposite. It's much more of the achievement. So depression is set in motion by some definite loss in either approval or achievement. You with me there? That's what begins to trigger it. The depression is set in motion by a loss in either approval or achievement. And by the way, the loss can either be subtle or it can be very obvious, as we'll get into later. You got your hand? Yeah.
You were in the contemporary mode of achievement, but it seemed like your loss was approval.
Yeah. And I need 2 hours to explain that one. That's a good cop-out, isn't it? You're going to find that ultimately both of them, at a very core level, are they're looking for a relationship. That's what we long for. At the very core. But there seems to be a level above that for these people. There seems to be a superficial level. This person, he's looking more for the achievement. This person more for the relationship at a more superficial type level. At the core, the longings are all the same. You know, we want to be loved, and in the context of that love, to feel the value of who we are and our Lord and all this type of thing. Can I say that again? Okay, yeah. Yeah, I would buy that at some level, because you're going to find that the people more in the dependent mode are going to do better quicker than the ones in the other mode. I mean, it's like beating your head against the wall with these other people. See, for one thing, the compensatory type people, you might say they're further away from feeling their longings. What do you do when you're hungry? You eat. These people aren't hungry. So therefore, for you to try to feed them, well, it's like force feeding them. Whereas the dependent mode person, he's already hungry. And so they're going to be much easier to work with. That's why the prognosis is much better for them. Yeah?
I'm just thinking they may be hungry, but they settle their appetite with junk food.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, they're full.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're full.
All the same.
Sure. Okay, now, therefore, the dynamics of depression, you might want to look at it this way. The loss times the pre-depressive personality. Of course, any loss evokes a legitimate sadness, but the pre-depressive person is going to have goals in the context of value and worth, and he is therefore, number one, he is dependent. In other words, he's demanding. You've got to keep that in mind. There's nothing wrong with being dependent. We all need to be dependent on God and what He chooses to supply and all this. But why I put demanding underneath that is it's really more than that. It's a demanding dependence. I've got to have something. Therefore, everything I do is going to be somehow subtly motivated out of doing one, out of accomplishing one thing, and that is gaining some type of relationship from other people or some type of achievement. So therefore, not only am I dependent on something definite or some definite events in which that he believes he needs. But beyond that, number two, he's not only dependent, but he's non-autonomous. In other words, compulsive. He doesn't see that what he does is a choice. He cannot act independently. His entire being, you might say, is consumed on the fruition of those events, of those things that he's trying to pursue. His appetite has taken him over. Give you just a moment to get some of that down. And again, if you want to see some of this after during break or afterwards, you're welcome to look.
Is everybody pre-depressive?
At some level, yeah. You see, the degree is the key. All of us fit into these two modes at some level. I mean, everybody in here. But it depends on the degree of the demandingness, you see. I certainly desire, even now, I mean, even as I'm up here, I desire that you all like me and that you walk out of here saying, yeah, he's a pretty nice guy. I think he kind of knows what he's talking about a little bit, maybe. Yeah, I want that. But I don't demand that anymore. Those of you that will walk out of here and say, geez, that was confusing. I think the guy, he just tried to snow us or whatever. That would hurt, but it would not destroy me, you see. That wouldn't trigger me into, oh, no, what am I... It would some people. And therefore, those type of people would probably walk out of here and not want to get any feedback because he wouldn't want to hear anything negative. Or when he did approach you for feedback, he would say, well, what'd you think? What do you feel like saying then? Oh, pretty good. Rather than, I'm curious, what's your response, to what happened today? There's going to be a difference there. Yeah.
Alongside this company? Or is there a point here that the evaluation that's made,
Yeah, a lot of that. Again, it's back to the 1-2-3 thing. If I sense that there's, if I sense that I'm just not getting through, and I've had some that, my goodness, I can remember one guy, he's just kind of like this. Every now and then he'd go like that. Well, obviously, you know something's going on there. You know, there's more than bad goals there. It would scare me. And so I, sent him away and get him some help, medical help. But there's other people who are going to be, well, just like Janine, on the tapes. I mean, she's depressed at some level, or she was. And yet the severity of the things that she was trying to accomplish, let me change that. The demandingness behind the things that she was trying to accomplish may not have been as severe as some of these people. That's why the loss for Janine in terms of her relationship and all that type of thing didn't elicit the same type of a depressed response in her that it would in some people, because the demandingness, the goal wasn't as tenaciously demanded. But again, it would always err on the side of getting some medical help. Don't be too proud. Yeah. Yeah.
The person with the high achievement organization, is he more prone towards the maybe the person with the bipolar aspect?
I haven't thought that through well enough. I really don't know. That's a good question. I don't really know. I know that there's usually so much organic, and chemical type things going on that. That's a good question. I just have to think it through. I really don't know. By the way, what I just said is not common for me, now that I think about it. As a compensatory person, probably 4 years ago, I would have given you an answer. And it may have been pure BS. But at least it would have got me off the hook. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. I've grown a little bit. Okay. So what I'm saying here is that the loss equals a blockage of goal. It equals the anger. And so dependency is primary. You might say that another good way of understanding depression is misplaced dependency. I'm dependent upon my own efforts to either acquire achievement or relationship. Of course, ultimately, it's all relationship, but still. There's a dependency that gets very, very demanding by the person. And he will therefore expend all of his mental energy thinking of ways to restore what was lost rather than reevaluating the importance of what was lost. You see that? When something is lost, they perceive it as the end of the world. I grieve, I hurt, I cry. If I were to go home and I found that my wife had an affair while I was gone, people, I would grieve, I would hurt, I would cry. But it would not destroy me because all my eggs aren't in that basket. You see that? In other words, what fills me up at the core of my being is not my wife's love. I don't need her to love me. Boy, I want it. I pray for it. I desire it. But I don't demand it. Therefore, if I don't have it, it will not destroy me. It'll hurt, but it won't destroy. Does that make sense to you? It may be a hard one to swallow. But ultimately, that's what we're saying. Now, one more here, and then we're going to take a break. If the depressive person cannot recover the loss, and or if the loss is too great to be denied, he will feel two things. All right? If the depressed person cannot recover what is lost, or if the loss is too great to somehow be denied, he will feel both cheated, number one, and impotent, number two. What do I mean by cheated? I've got a sentence here. The world has let me down. I've not been given what I need. Therefore, there's a preoccupation with the loss which prevents any type of developing awareness of the manipulative demand which has somehow made the loss so tragic in the first place. Again, there's no awareness of the depravity there. There's no awareness of the demand. Yeah.
Do they substitute God for world in that sense? God's letting down?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you very well could. Yeah, I'm dealing with a man right now who bought into the lie that if you give God a 5, he'll give you back a 10. You know, he claimed the promise God never made, and after tithing for most all of his life, his business fell apart.